In China, the earth moves.
It's a little bit startling. We wondered what it was. At first, it sounded like the wind, and you could hear the drapes flapping back and forth across the windows.
A few hours ago, a powerful 7.8 earthquake has hit near populated areas of central China. The early death toll is expected to climb. Myanmar struggles a week after the cyclone and deadly weather in the U.S. Climate changes and plate tectonics. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 12th. In the United States, powerful storms in three states killed 22 people over the weekend. This week, hard decisions for Democrats as West Virginia heads to the polls. In Iraq, there's a quiet war being fought for millions of disabled people. And we talk with a reluctant celebrity. That and all the news. This morning, the U.S. Geological Survey says an earthquake with a preliminary magnitude of 7.8 struck central China. The quake hit northwest of the Sichuan province, though it was felt as far away as Pakistan, Vietnam, and Thailand. Several schools collapsed, burying 900 students. Chinese officials report so far the quake has caused 107 deaths.
Survivors are picking up what's left of their homes after storms smashed through the plains and the south over the weekend. At least 15 people died in southwestern Missouri. In the mining town of Pitcher, Oklahoma, at least six people were killed. Brandy Garcia and her family survived a direct hit.
My mom and my aunt and my niece all got into the bathtub, and my two uncles were standing in the hallway, and right before the roof came off of the house, they jumped into the bathroom.
U.S. officials say the United States has launched its first relief effort to Myanmar for cyclone victims. A military C-130 cargo plane packed with supplies departed from a Thai airbase south of Bangkok. It landed in Yangon a few hours ago. The flight is evidence the Myanmar government is responding to pressure to open the country to foreign aid workers and supplies. The official death toll is approaching 30,000.
Brush fires have forced residents to flee their homes in central Florida and closed parts of Interstate 95. Authorities say a fire in Volusia County has burned between 500 and 600 acres.
The wedding was a spectacular. It's all we could have hoped for.
President Bush had a welcome distraction from the affairs of state. His daughter Jenna tied the knot at the Bush-Crawford, Texas ranch over the weekend. The president said his new son-in-law, Henry Hager, is a really good guy. The festivities were presided over by the Reverend Kirbyon Caldwell of Windsor Village United Methodist Church in Houston. Reverend Caldwell has endorsed Senator Barack Obama for president. The Dow opens down 121 points. The S&P opens slightly above 1388 this morning.
And we're asking, what would you do? How would you tax? What would you tax to help your state with budget shortfalls? Here's what someone had to say.
My name is John Lynch. I'm from Cape Cod. I believe that we should either have the government take over the oil companies or we should apply a tax on the oil companies at the point of entrance into the state, not at the pump. Bye-bye.
So nationalize the oil companies or just tax crimes and junk food, like Hayes says via our website. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What would you tax to reduce your state's deficit?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A rapidly developing story in China. As we've reported, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake buried 900 students in central China on Monday and killed at least 107 people. That's all according to China's official Xinhua news agency. Several schools and a water tower reportedly collapsed in the trembler. The quake was felt as far away as the Vietnamese capital of Hanoi, where some people hurried out of swaying buildings there into the streets downtown. We have on the line New York Times' Jim Yardley in Beijing. Jim, I gather you could feel this quake, even though you were 900 miles or so away from the epicenter, you could feel it pretty strongly.
Well, John, there was, we actually, I think what happened in Beijing is there was a second quake that happened outside the city a few minutes after the first quake. The first quake was about 900 miles to the west in Sichuan province, and that was felt all over the place. But the State Seismological Bureau has also reported that a second, far smaller quake was occurred a few minutes later outside Beijing, and that was felt around here. I must admit, I'm on the first floor. I did not feel it, but other people did, and people in high-rise buildings reported swaying and became quite worried, and many, many buildings were evacuated here in the city.
Well, originally there were no reports of damage or injuries, and the state media was quick to say that the Three Gorges Dam was fine, which is actually fairly near to the epicenter, but now we're getting some fairly disturbing reports of widespread civilian casualties. What can you tell us?
Well, we're all sort of scrambling right now to figure out what's going on, and I think that the government, just like those of us in the foreign media, are hampered by the fact that telephone communications in this region are severely damaged. One report from China Mobile, which is the main cell phone carrier here in China, said that 2,300 cell phone towers were knocked down. So this is a country where cell phone coverage is spectacular, but you have essentially a hole in the grid right now in the area around Wenchuan County, which is located about 55 miles northwest of Chengdu, which is the provincial capital of Sichuan. And so efforts to call in there have been very difficult. People in my office here have reached people in Chengdu and in another mountainous tourist area, which is called Jiujiago. And in both of those places, the damage reports are pretty slim. But in Wenchuan, we really haven't been able to get through to anybody. And then another county, Duchangyan, well, I think that's where the real most severe reports are starting to come out. That's the county. It's about 600,000 people. It's probably about 35, 40 miles from Chengdu. And we've seen the report of the school collapse with 900 pupils, students who are feared trapped. And we've also had state media report, one local official has said that rows of houses have collapsed. So we don't really know yet how bad this is going to get, but it doesn't look especially
doesn't look
good right now.
No. How has the political leadership responded at this point?
Well, it's interesting. And that was one of the early signs to me that this was going to be a big problem, because almost immediately before any of the death tolls were out, the prime minister, Wen Jiabao, had flown directly to the scene, and the president, Hu Jintao, had called for all-out efforts and had dispatched soldiers to the relief effort. So that told us pretty quickly this was going to be a problem.
Is this a test for China in some sense? I mean, certainly the response to earthquakes and disasters in the past has been uneven for a whole variety of reasons. It's an important year for China. What do you think?
Oh, it's certainly a test, and it's a test in many levels. First of all, it's just a test to the Chinese people to get there to respond quickly. You know, there was a big weather problem in southern China earlier in the year, and a major unexpected freeze, and the government received a fair bit of criticism for how it handled that. I mean, there was train transportation was shut down for a long time, and thousands of migrant workers and other people were trapped. This is a test in that regard. I think it's also a test in their sort of promise to be a more accountable and open society, which is the last major earthquake here was in 1976 in Tangshan, which is outside Beijing, and originally the government covered up the death toll, and there were, I think, 240,000 people who were killed, and that only came out several years later. I do think state media so far, at least, has been certainly publicizing death tolls and other reports, so I think they recognize that they have a responsibility
certainly
to be more accountable than they have been in the past.
A lot is on the line. Jim Yardley, thank you so much for joining us. Jim Yardley of the New York Times in Beijing.
Certainly disturbing news, and we'll continue to follow that story as we have also been following what's going on in Myanmar, also known as Burma. Early this morning, the first U.S. plane carrying aid landed in Yangon, about 20,000 pounds of aid. It's a rare move for the ruling junta, which has resisted offers for military aid to allow the plan to land. And it is carrying supplies like blankets and drinking water, but there are no aid workers
That's
aboard that plane. We're going now to Peter Popham, who is a roving foreign correspondent for The Independent, for the very latest. And Peter, is this a breakthrough of sorts?
Yes, it's certainly a breakthrough. I mean, it's the first time that an American plane has landed in Burma ever, I should think. An aid plane. Certainly the first time since the cyclone struck. So it's a big step in the right direction.
And Peter, here's the real question, though, because there were lots of reports over the weekend about the fact that some aid, not enough, has been allowed into the country, but it's not necessarily getting to the people who need it. In fact, we heard reports about how military officials were diverting some of that aid to support their referendum on the Constitution, which went forward on Saturday. What are you hearing?
Yes, well, that's what I've been hearing as well. The problem is that if you don't have the agencies, people on the ground in considerable numbers, you have no way of controlling what happens to the aid you're bringing in. And in particular, in the case of Burma, there's very little grounds for expecting that the Burmese regime would make good use of the aid. They're not geared up to helping the people in large numbers. In a way, there is a relationship of settled enmity between the regime and the people they govern, as is shown by the not infrequent uprisings that occur.
And Peter, I guess it's really hard when you're watching this story unfold from afar. It's been a week. There is no question that there are tens of thousands of people who are in dire need at the moment. Very low supplies of water, of food, of so on. How is the government? How is the government trying to help?
Well, certainly they are set up camps for displaced people. On the fringes of the areas most badly affected by the cyclone. Apparently the conditions inside those camps are terrible. People are being restricted to like one cup of rice a day, according to a report I've just seen. And there are lots of more refugees who are swarming out as best they can out of their devastated villages. The estimate of Oxfam, who would be a charity one would love to see on the ground because they're so brilliant at dealing with water problems. They're saying that there's a danger of 1.5 million people being in severe trouble in the short term. And so the problem is we're not really seeing this because journalists are not allowed to roam freely. There are roadblocks into the affected area. Aid workers are not getting there. We're getting a very limited picture of the extent of the devastation. And, of course, as we know as journalists, the length of time in which the media are interested in any given catastrophe is around a week and not much more.
Yeah,
public attention is going to disappear into this issue while hundreds of thousands are still in terrible peril.
And how do these aids or aid organizations as well as other governments, how do you even begin negotiating with the junta?
Well, as we've seen by the fact that the American plane arrived today, and I believe there's another one going to arrive tomorrow, they are beginning to see reason. One hears from Burmese sources who pay close attention to the dealings inside the regime that there are strong differences of opinion between Tan Shwe, who is the strongman who's been the unchallenged ruler of Burma for the last 16 years, and his immediate subordinates. There are differences of view about the attitude towards the outside world and the attitude towards aid, with some of his junior subordinates urging him to be more flexible. So there is some kind of a power struggle
But hold on, Peter, but right there. So you're saying that there is ongoing debate within the junta itself as opposed to it just being ongoing debate between other parties and the junta?
Sorry, I missed that.
No, I'm just saying very quickly because we're almost running out of time, but you were saying that there's actual debate going on within the military regime itself as opposed to just debate between the junta and other parties.
Well, I mean, clearly there are negotiations, tortuous negotiations, I think, took place between the Americans and the regime to allow this one plane, this first plane to arrive, mm-hmm. and then to allow the second one to arrive tomorrow. What's happening inside the regime would appear to be a vicious struggle between Tan Shwe, who is the strong man, and the people who are urging a more flexible approach to the outside world, who are his subordinates.
Peter Popham, roving foreign correspondent for The Independent, thank you so much for that update.
Thank you.
Well, that's certainly interesting.
Yeah, they're struggling in Myanmar.
They're struggling
on every level.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Stepping away from the news for a moment, we're talking about states that are in debt. More than half of the states are in debt, facing a fiscal crisis because economic woes are causing tax receipts to decline. So what do you do if you are a state and trying to reduce your deficit? What do you tax to get that money back? Tax the income of the U.S. bourgeoisie, not workers or the poor, says Mike via our website. And tax business, not workers. If I buy the kids a chocolate bar, I pay sales tax. If I buy shares in the chocolate company, I don't. That's according to Kevin. So you're in a predicament if you're a state and you have a deficit. And often states go after products that people have to buy no matter what the price is. For instance, an assemblyman in California proposed a tax on six packs of beer and got this response.
Do we support Assemblymember Bell's tax increase?
No!
He's going to tax us college students to death.
No new taxes! No new taxes! No new taxes! No.
Beer drinking and civically engaged college students proposing a proposal from California State Assemblyman Jim Bell, who is actually here to talk about his recently introduced, to deal with the California fiscal crisis, his recently introduced six-pack tax. Good morning, Assemblyman.
Good morning.
First of all, what is the strategy of going after beer, and what other kinds of products is California considering to raise taxes on that have the similar kind of effect, where people really like their product and are inclined to pay the tax for it?
Well, California's tax on beer right now is 20 cents per gallon, and that's an excise tax that's paid by the beer distributors and hasn't been raised since 1991. So we're looking at raising the tax. Of course, the beer lobby is a very powerful lobby, as you just heard.
Do you actually describe them as a lobby?
Yeah,
they,
I do.
They feel like a lobby. So,
well, those people that were yelling no taxation on intoxication in front of my office were they went over to the microbrewery afterward for free beer.
I see. Well, so there's a so everybody's in on this tax protest. You are raising the price or the tax quite significantly. I mean, you said it's 30 cents per gallon, but you're going to raise it to $1.80 per six pack. That's a more than 1,000% increase. I mean, you would expect to get some sort of.
We haven't raised it yet.
Right, right. But that's a significant increase. Maybe you would consider something smaller.
Well, actually, my legislation hasn't been finalized yet. We're considering anywhere from 5 cents to $1.80. So we haven't determined that, and we're taking a poll on what the tax should be. But it hasn't. The point is, it hasn't been raised since 1991. And that's a long time without adjusting it.
So what would the revenue be used for? Reducing the debt, or are you interested in some more programmatic uses for that money?
I'm trying to develop a strategy of, as chair of the Alcohol and Substance Abuse Committee of the state legislature, to use it specifically for dealing with underage drinking, the effects of alcohol on our society. It cost $36 billion in California to health, law enforcement, crime, lost productivity. So alcohol does have a big effect on the state budget in many ways.
In a time of fiscal crisis, though, do you have control over where the money goes? Isn't there enormous pressure for money to just sort of end up into the general fund to bring the deficit down?
Yes, and that's why we're putting together, this is a constitutional amendment, which would be voted on by the people of California, and it would be locked into those alcohol-related health impacts and criminal justice impacts. So we're going to lock the money into specifically responding to things like underage drinking and rehabilitation programs and so forth.
Mr. Assemblyman, the bottom line is California, like so many states, is facing an enormous deficit. I've seen estimates as up to $15, $20 billion. Obviously, this would just be one small thing. What other ways do you see the state generating that revenue? For example, what kind of cuts do you see that are likely to be made in addition to other taxes that perhaps might be raised?
Well, California's budget is about $142 billion, and we're talking about at least a 10% reduction. The question is where you make the cuts, and then combine that with some revenue increases or taxes, if you want to call them that. I think expanding the sales tax to cover more items, like other states have done, is one way. The other way is to make cuts. We have the biggest cost driver in California, of course, is the state prison system, which has increased 74% in the last 4 years.
Tough calls, tough calls. Jim Bell, California State Assembly member from San Jose, California. Thank you so much.
Certainly lots at stake, and that's why we're asking, what would you do to fix your state's budget crisis? The premise of your question is wrong, Richard tells us. Why tax to balance a budget? Cut spending and work on reducing the horrific waste government creates. So we'd like to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And now time for more headlines from Femi Okeh.
Good morning to you. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Making news this hour, severe weather is forcing evacuations and damaging homes in Delaware. And the first U.S. flight is into Myanmar. Navy ships are also heading into the region to provide more relief supplies if Myanmar's government gives them permission. Chinese state news agency is reporting that a powerful earthquake has killed more than 100 people and 900 school children are buried in central China. Eyewitness reports from the earthquake area are just beginning to come in. Ann Zuckerman is an American teacher based in Chengdu, which is just south of where the earthquake struck.
I was very lucky that I was in a very open area, and I saw students beginning to pour out of buildings and realized that I felt the ground shaking, and it kept on shaking for about a minute.
The earthquake measured 7.8 on the Richter scale. The future of Pakistan's fledgling coalition government hangs in the balance today after failed talks on how to restore judges sacked by President Pervez Musharraf. The party of ex-Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was set to discuss later in the day whether to abandon its alliance with the senior party of Asif Ali Zardari, who's the widower of slain former Premier Benazir Bhutto. The new government came to power just 6 weeks ago. South Korean officials confirmed that they have killed all poultry in Seoul, the capital. The culling in the capital city is hoped to stop the spread of bird flu following a new outbreak of the disease. Quarantine officials destroyed 15,000 chickens, ducks, pheasants and turkeys raised in farms, restaurants, schools and homes in the capital. The Seoul government will now focus on preventing live poultry from being brought into the capital. That's going to be a tough job.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
All the poultry in Seoul.
15,000.
It must be more than that. It has to be more than that. But I don't. Maybe it was a slow day for chicken.
Wow.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 12th, and we're going to turn our attentions to Iraq, where there are 2 million Iraqis who are disabled. And, John, we found that number to be quite staggering, and not just staggering because of the enormity of the issue, but in a country where basic services are sporadic, services for the disabled can be non-existent, even unpaved roads can be a problem, that just creates an enormity of problems that need to be addressed in order to make their lives more livable. We're going to turn to Tiana Tozer. She is a manager of Persons with Disabilities and a gender program for Mercy Corps. You've been working in Iraq to help train disabled Iraqis to advocate for services that would help them. Describe the need for us and what the obstacles are.
Well, not only do Iraqis face a lack of access to basic infrastructure and basic services. They have difficulty getting to school. Adults with disabilities are unemployed. They lack basic resources, and even just the ability to get around is lacking.
And what?
Go ahead.
No, I think we have a bit of a delay here, which is why we might step on each other a bit. But what? Where do you start then in a place where there's such this enormous need?
Well, the major barrier that people with disabilities face around the world is not actually infrastructure. It's the attitudes that people have towards them and the attitudes that they have towards themselves. So you start by empowering Iraqis to identify their own needs and then advocate for their own needs, because they're the only ones who can change the situation for themselves.
And what kind of conversations have you had when you're saying that part of it is just beginning to talk about it? Why doesn't that happen?
There's a general conception, and it's not entirely true, but among the uneducated Arab community, that people with disabilities are cursed by God, particularly those that are born with disabilities. It's often shameful to have a person with a disability as a member of your family. So there's a shame associated with having a person with a disability. And then there's also associated with that shame is what do you do with them? We can't get them to school. There's no purpose for them.
Well, Tiana, having spent a lot of time in the Middle East, as you have, in many ways it's hard to understand why this shame manifests itself so sort of uniformly throughout the country. It is true that some more educated Iraqis tend to respond more to advocacy, but in my experience, whether you're talking about Iran, Iraq, or the Palestinian community, it's really, really difficult to get families to understand that the best solution for their disabled loved one is actually to confront the authorities to get more services rather than to just sit back and accept a feeling of hopelessness.
Yes, I agree with you entirely. It is very difficult to get families to do that. So it's important that you start with the person with the disability, that we change their attitude toward themselves, and through that, hopefully, they can change their family's attitude.
Can you tell a story of someone whose face lit up when you finally convinced them that, in fact, there was a way to step over the shame and maybe to step out into the light of their own communities?
That's an interesting question. I can tell you that in the recent training that I just finished, We were teaching them how to educate children about people with disabilities. And we took them to a school, and they gave presentations. And at first, the children were sort of afraid, and the people with disabilities were sort of hanging back and were feeling a little uncomfortable. And afterwards, there were these big, huge smiles on everyone's faces. The kids were surrounding the wheelchairs. They were talking with the deaf participants. They had so many questions, and there were just big smiles all around.
And that, of course, Tiana, is because universally wheelchairs are awesomely cool when kids are around. Isn't that correct?
That is completely right. Wheelchairs are awesomely cool.
It takes kids to figure that out, and once the adults see the kids, obviously it's wrong to say that, a couple of meetings between kids and adults is going to change things in Iraq. What are the investment needs long-term that you think that country is going to need?
Well, one of the things that Mercy Corps has done is we've brought together the disability organizations in Iraq under an alliance called the Iraqi Alliance of Disability Organizations, and we're working with them to identify their priorities and help them speak with one voice.
And in fact, you're actually helping to get some wheelchairs over to Iraq. How's that working?
Very slowly, but hopefully we will get them there soon. They're Whirlwind wheelchairs. They're designed for...
Oh, really smart. Companies. You went with Whirlwind. Whirlwind is the best company in the universe. And Adora, this is a really great story. They design wheelchairs that can be repaired and maintained with local technology right there in Iraq. Right, Tiana?
Yes, that's true, and they can also drop off frontwards off a 12-inch curb, which I was really impressed with, without throwing the rider out of the wheelchair.
Nice. You can't do that in the United States.
No, definitely not.
And I just want to say, Tiana, you're quite the athlete. I understand that you won a silver medal in the Barcelona Paralympics. For what?
I played wheelchair basketball on the USA women's wheelchair basketball team for 6 years. I competed in Barcelona and Atlanta.
Tiana Tovzer coming to us from Amman Jordan, manager of the Persons with Disabilities and Gender Program for Mercy Corps in Iraq. Thanks.
That's a great, great story. To shift subjects for a minute, we are asking all of you, if you're in your state government and trying to reduce the deficit, what would you tax? What would be the target to bring that revenue up, to get rid of the deficit? Here's one answer.
Hey, this is Rob from Manhattan. And to fix my state's budget crisis, I would tax, regulate, and legalize marijuana. Thanks.
Hey, Rob. Thanks, Rob. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Rob. Thanks for calling, Rob.
Okay, time for more headlines.
That was Rob.
Femi Oke is here with them.
At 21 minutes to the hour, weather is in the news today. Hundreds of people in central Florida have been evacuated because of brush fires that have also closed a portion of Interstate 95. Rescuers are evacuating coastal communities in Delaware, battling heavy rain and high tides. High winds collapsed a house in Maryland, and tornadoes over the weekend killed 22 people in Oklahoma, Missouri, and Georgia. And in international news, top Sudanese opposition leader Hassan Turabi has been arrested following an unprecedented assault by Darfuri rebels on Sudan's capital Khartoum this weekend. Sudan's government accuses Turabi of collaborating with rebels from the Justice and Equality Movement. Moving on with more international news, just getting this information from Chinese state television. State television is broadcasting tips for survivors who are trapped following the massive quake that hit Western China earlier on today, telling them to, and I quote, keep calm, conserve your energy, seek water and food, and wait patiently for rescue. I'm sure we will be following up on that story on The Takeaway in the next couple of days. And finally, how do you know when you've really become an icon? How about having a spider named after you? East Carolina University biologist Jason Bond has discovered a new species of trapdoor spider and decided to call it Myrmecia phyla Neil Youngi after his favourite musician, who I'm sure you've just guessed who it is.
Neil Young. He's got a spider named after him. Thanks,
Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We are following reports of devastation in China following a 7.8 Richter scale earthquake. Early reports just coming in. Also, difficulties in getting relief aid to the people of Myanmar a week after the cyclone. And devastating weather overnight here in the United States, in the southwest, or in the southeast, and in the Plain States. But it was a very, very difficult day yesterday for the Takeaway's pundit meter, trying to figure out what the theme was, what the word of the Sunday talk shows actually was. And I think you'll be able to hear our agony here.
Senator Clinton campaigns on. The question, why?
Is Barack Obama going to be the Democratic nominee?
Yes, he will be, Tim. I think that's very clear today.
Pretty obvious at this point.
It's hard to see how he's not the nominee.
The math doesn't work in her favor.
The math is very, very hard for her.
It's past the tipping point. Senator Clinton has no chance.
Senator John Edwards knows what hard math is about. He dropped out of the race months ago. So, yes, whether you're talking about tipping point or end game or exit strategy, it was difficult for the Sunday talk shows to find a theme to jump on. And I think, you know, if it's obvious that Barack Obama is going to be the nominee, it was difficult for them to talk about anything because obvious doesn't really play.
No, it doesn't play. And the bottom line is not every state has voted. And no Barack Obama, and no, obviously it's going to be, or yes, I should say, if I could just get this out. Yes, it's going to be difficult when you look at the abstract numbers for her to catch Barack Obama. But
it's
I
impossible.
Think anyone is, well, you're weary of saying impossible.
Jimmy Kimmel said the only
impossible.
Way, Jimmy Kimmel said the only way that Barack Obama can lose to Hillary Clinton is if he marries Bill Clinton.
Okay.
That'd be the only way.
Was that supposed to be funny?
Well, no, I think it just sort of says we're in the impossible zone. How does David Axelrod, the campaign director for the Barack Obama campaign, how does he spin it?
I think that Senator Clinton cares about the Democratic Party. I think she cares about this country. I think she understands how much we need change in this country. And I don't think she wants to impair our chances to achieve that.
Which is sort of a commentary on the style going forward. And I guess the test is tomorrow in West Virginia. Are we going to see a sort of more tiptoeing kind of campaign where these two candidates don't batter each other?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I think we read a lot about this weekend, which is there are some in the Democratic leadership who say, let her go ahead and finish. It's been a tough road. Let these states count. Let people go to vote. As long as she does not start hurling heavy criticisms and trying to go negative, as they say, against Barack Obama.
So what are we to make of this audio?
There was just an AP article posted that found how Senator Obama's support among working, hardworking Americans, white Americans, is weakening again, and how the, you know, whites in both states who had not completed college were supporting me.
You can hear her struggling with that, but it's basically a saying, you know, whites vote for me. You can't support Barack Obama.
Well,
what is that all about?
That in part was in response to West Virginia, which is 94% white out of the 1.8 million folks who live there. But you have to wonder, where are you going with that, Hillary Clinton?
I think she was wondering it as if she was saying it. All those pauses in there. You know, the
What's
talk
the upside
shows
for her on that?
Yeah,
what's
I
the
don't
upside to point that out?
The question is, will that be put to bed in West Virginia? We'll be right back.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 12th, and we are following the powerful earthquake that hit China overnight. So far, Chinese officials say 107 people dead. We're also following the relief efforts in Myanmar. We understand a U.S. plane with aid has landed there. And as always, John, we are covering politics. We're taking a look at the presidential nomination process. And the question here is the fight over for the Democratic nomination? Not in West Virginia, at least not if you ask Hillary Clinton. She is ahead there by 43 points, at least according to a recent poll. Barack Obama is making campaign stops there, though, today, as is Hillary Clinton. Anna Sale is covering the primary for West Virginia Public Radio. And the governor says it's the first time in nearly five decades West Virginians feel important in a presidential primary.
Of course, it was 1960 when John Kennedy and Hubert Humphreys were battling it out in West Virginia, and we haven't had this kind of attention since, and it's a lot of attention. Hillary Clinton is making four campaign stops across the state today, and Barack Obama will be in the state capitol in Charleston, West Virginia today. Hillary Clinton, of course, has been here a lot over the last week. She spent four of the last 6 days in West Virginia, and she's really trying to frame this state as a key test for the nomination, that she can win what she calls the hardworking voters in West Virginia, referring to the blue-collar demographics in this state. But it's not clear if anybody's paying attention. As she's been making this case in West Virginia, Barack Obama overtook her in the superdelegate lead, of course.
That's really interesting. There's two points I want to get to you with you. One is there are 28 delegates at stake, and the question is the vote there really relevant? But you just mentioned what Hillary Clinton has been saying over the weekend. We actually have a clip of that, so let's just take a quick listen.
I think it's fair to say that West Virginia is a test. It's a test for me, and it's a test for Senator Obama. Because for too long, we have let places like West Virginia slip out of the Democratic column. And, you know, it is a fact that no president, Democratic president, has ever won the White House since 1916 without winning West Virginia. That's how important the voters of West Virginia are.
That's an important, or rather I should say a very interesting fact, but it seems like all kinds of precedents have been broken in this race. The bottom line is, though, Hillary Clinton is at 1689 with the delegates and Barack Obama is at 1865. So even, Anna, if she won all of the delegates there in West Virginia, she still wouldn't be ahead.
And Barack Obama has acknowledged that Hillary Clinton has a wide lead. He called it insurmountable in both West Virginia and our border state, Kentucky, which has its primary next week. So Hillary Clinton is trying to get every single vote she can in West Virginia, but what happens after this week, I'm not sure.
And how would you describe the headlines there in West Virginia, besides just the fact that both candidates are coming? What do folks there care about most right now?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the coverage is pulling aside voters who are showing up at these Hillary Clinton rallies that have been happening across the state and asking them, you know, if they really think that their candidate can be the nominee. And at the event I covered last week, voters were split. There were some that said, I know she's not going to be the nominee, but I just wanted to come out and support her because I like her. And now the conversation is shifting here in West Virginia to, well, if Hillary Clinton is not the nominee, who's going to get your support in the general election? And there was actually a poll done last week that showed that while Hillary Clinton would get about two-thirds of the Democratic primary votes, while McCain would get about 26%, 24%, it was about half and half Obama with McCain among Democratic primary voters.
I wonder, Anna, if what the test is here is that, you know, West Virginia may be a state that tests the viability of an Obama-Hillary ticket. Would those West Virginia voters go for a ticket that included Hillary?
That was actually something that came up. My colleague was covering Hillary Clinton event last night, and one voter said, you know, under no circumstances am I voting for Barack Obama. And then she said, well, if Hillary Clinton is on the ballot anywhere, that would get my vote.
Interesting.
And it's also interesting that 86% of residents are registered Democrats, so you would think that there would be a proclivity towards the Democratic candidate.
That's actually just in one county. In West Virginia, 56% of West Virginians are registered Democrats.
And you don't pay much attention to your own senator. Jay Rockefeller came out for Obama like back in February, right?
Right. Jay Rockefeller and another southern West Virginia congressman who represents the southern West Virginia coalfields is supporting Barack Obama.
Anna Sale, thank you. Anna Sale is a reporter for West Virginia Public Radio.
And reports this morning, Terry McAuliffe of the Clinton campaign is already emailing all over the place saying that if Hillary wins a big, big popular vote in West Virginia, it may push her popular vote numbers ahead of Barack Obama. That's also pretty unlikely.
There's one thing we can say for absolute certain. This has been one fascinating primary season.
It's starting to wear on me, which is why I'm going to change the subject right now.
Okay.
We're going to talk about something very, very, very different. Benefits supervisor sleeping is a nude painting, okay? But it's safe to say it probably reminds no one of Manet's Olympia. A famous nude from the French Impressionist period, or any of Renoir's nudes, right?
No.
But it is expected to fetch up to $35 million at an auction tomorrow night at Christie's. And the benefits supervisor, who is the subject of that Lucian Freud painting, which goes on the block tomorrow night, is Sue Tilley. And we've got her on the phone at the welfare office she manages in central London.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So you describe yourself, tongue-in-cheek, as the first nudie pinup to ever make the pages of the Financial Times, correct?
Yeah, I don't know if it was true or not. I said maybe I am, and then people decided I was.
Well, if the Lucian Freud painting benefits supervisors sleeping, and we should say that it is a very sort of, candid, nude painting of you, of a woman who is really quite evocative, but is also quite ordinary. I mean, there's no sort of idealized kind of sexuality in this painting, correct?
No, not really. No.
Not really, no. If it gets $35 million, that's going to be a record.
Very exciting.
A record for a living painter.
I know. And I think probably of a painting of a living person.
Yeah. I was thinking that, too.
Yeah.
Have you thought of putting photographs of yourself on eBay just to sort of cash in on this a little bit?
I should do.
I think
it's very
should.
Nice Bruce Bernard photos, but they're very expensive, I think, now.
Yeah.
So let me get this straight. Lucian is going to get $35 million.
No, Lucian's not going to get any money either.
No, the collector's
going to get that money.
Yeah,
but
Lucian,
how much did you make while posing for this picture?
Well, I got paid about $40 a day, I'd say. Well, £20. But it didn't matter because it was interesting. It was a learning. I mean, much people would pay to have that time with painter like Lucien, and got lots of treats, got taken out for dinner, you know.
He actually gave you...
The money. I had another job as well, so that was just like extras, you know.
Right, right. But he gave you a lithograph, didn't he?
Yes, yeah, three.
Oh, that's great. And you sold them for more than $60. So.
Yes, I didn't do bad.
So you did all right. But you're not an art collector. Why?
How can I afford to be an art collector on my salary? I have got bits of art in my flat. But
so then you're an art collector.
There are things I've acquired that people have given me, really.
Are you a little nervous about having the painting sort of plastered all over the news over the next couple of days, depending on what the
price
is?
Well, it was all over the news 4 weeks ago when it first came out, so I'm used to it now, and I think everybody who's seen it's going to see it. So, I mean, it's been in cartoons over here, everything.
What do you think people think when they see the painting?
I don't know. People think different things. Some people think, oh, God, look at that fat girl. And others think, oh, that's so beautiful. It's fantastic. I'm really jealous. I wish I could have been painted by Lucien. I mean, everybody thinks something different.
But, Sue, so, I mean, the irony of this is, of course, you know, you've been going to the gym like crazy over the last year. I mean, no one would even recognize you. You don't look anything like the painting anymore, right?
No, I don't really. Nobody would recognize me from the painting, I don't think. But sometimes in the papers, my proper picture's been on. In the paper, you know, as now.
Right.
So I have been recognized on the bus.
Well, Sue, it's a great experience. Good luck at the auction. I suppose you'll be rooting for the painting, right?
I know. It's not going to be till about 1:30, I shouldn't think, in the morning, our time here. So I'm going to stay up late and be very excited.
Sue Tilley, an important milestone in the art world, and she gets to experience it firsthand. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Sue Tilley, who's a welfare officer, and the subject of benefits of the painting, the Lucien Ford painting that goes on the block tomorrow night.
Making history. I just want to talk about a wire that we've just gotten from the Associated Press saying that the Chinese media is reporting that the quake death toll in one Sichuan county is estimated at 3,000 to 5,000 people, and this is referring to the very powerful earthquake hitting 7.8 on the Richter scale that hit China overnight.
As
so
expected,
these numbers have exploded in even
rising.
An hour ago we were talking about 107th deaths. Now we're talking about up to 5,000 deaths.
Stay tuned for updates on the takeaway.org. You can also register your tax suggestions to fix your state's budget crisis at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And you can revisit my visit to California and the Serious Play Conference, including a video talking about what serious play actually means.
Yeah, that could be a heated discussion.
It could be. You can download our entire show, of course, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Freeman Foundation, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.